Welcome to Suffolk Matters, where all of Suffolk County meets the men and women of Suffolk AME. News, opinions, and insights you won't hear anywhere else. Here's your host, the president of New York's largest independent union, Suffolk AME's Dan Leveler.
Welcome to another edition of Suffolk Matters on Walk 97.5 and 94.3 The Shark, where Suffolk County meets the men and women of Suffolk AME. News and views you can't hear anywhere else.
So my guest this morning is John Manzi. He's the Fire Rescue and Emergency Services Unit President at Suffolk AME. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We're thrilled to have you. And I think there's a lot of things that we need to get into. Just talking about what, so I said before, Fire Rescue and Emergency Services, we'll abbreviate that as FRES from here on out. But let's go a little bit into what you do for the county on a day-to-day basis. You know, what does it mean to be someone that works at FRES?
So FRES has a lot of responsibilities. We have the Fire Marshal's Office. We have the Office of Emergency Management. We have the Emergency Communications Dispatchers, and we have administrative staff. And we also have the Fire Academy, which is a contract agency that falls under our jurisdiction.
Yeah, and so I mean, the Fire Academy is definitely, one of those places where people in the various volunteer fire departments across the county get certain level of training and maybe even accredited. And
There's about 109 fire departments in Suffolk County. They come out and they do training there from the initial Firefighter 1 training up through advanced training, hazardous materials, technical rescue. And then at FRES, I work in the Fire Marshal's Office. We do inspections of county-owned, operated, leased, and rented buildings. We also do quite a few of the public school districts in the throughout the county.
Right. Yeah.
We do, training, fire safety, extinguishers. The Office of Emergency Management does a lot of preparedness work. They meet with a lot of different groups, hurricane preparedness, emergency preparedness. And then obviously the dispatchers are constantly taking 911 phone calls and helping people.
Sure. And, I guess it's worth pointing out, so all of these emergency services, when someone calls 911 and they need, say their issue requires a police officer to be dispatched, that would come out of police emergency. But if it has to do with emergency rescue services, that transfers over to your call center, and then, all the maps aren't necessarily like lined up. Like this neighborhood is this, is this particular fire department, and like, so there needs to be a wealth of knowledge about, what's where, who to call, in the dispatching side of things.
Oh yeah, a lot of these district lines or boundaries have existed for decades, and they don't necessarily line up what we would think geographically or by sometimes a road. The east side of the road might be one district, the west side of the road might be a different district.
Right.
So they have to go through a lot of trying to figure out exactly where the caller is, what the nearest cross street is. Like, how many times have you been driving and you're on Sunrise, what exit did I pass? And
right.
People don't know east and west. They don't know directions.
Yeah.
These are all issues dispatchers have to overcome with somebody who might be understandably a little upset or a little frantic on the phone as they're calling for an emergency. So.
Yeah, and another thing we've talked about before is when an emergency happens, you're probably not just getting one call from one person, especially like if it's say a roadway incident and like say cars on fire or something like that, 30 cars passing by may be calling all of this in, and you only have a certain amount of people to take calls, and you want to make sure that other calls can get through, and so there's a lot to that.
Yeah, and you also have to make sure that it is in fact the same accident. How many times are you driving one way and someone's not paying attention the other way and they cause a separate unrelated accident?
Right.
So yeah, there's only so many call takers available. There's only so many rollover lines, and they have to make sure that they're getting the information but not spending too long on any one phone call so that the phone is available for other people who might have a separate or an unrelated emergency.
Sure. So, let's just talk about the type of people who take this job. What motivated someone like yourself and your coworkers to get involved in this line of work?
I think a lot of the people who work for FRES started as volunteers, either as firefighters or emergency medical technicians, paramedics. I think a lot of people are attracted to this. Growing up, how many people wanted to be a police officer, a fireman, or a paramedic?
Right.
And then I think a lot of it, too, is family. Like me personally, that's how I got involved. My father was a firefighter. My grandfather was a firefighter. I think a lot of people also join because somebody else from the neighborhood, somebody they're high school with or they're in a group with joined. And it becomes a social aspect on top of. Plus, I think most people honestly want to serve their community. They want to help other people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a big thing. You know, we talk about often, you know, the altruistic nature of, you know, AME members, you know, that desire to give back to the community. You know, you could get a job pretty much anywhere doing anything, so to speak. People who are seeking out government work are looking to not just live in their community, but actively serve their community. And that's, you know, I mean, it's definitely a testament to all those that work at Fres for sure. In a similar vein, you know, what motivated you to get involved in union work and representing, you know, the members over at the Fire Rescue Emergency Services?
I think having a union, having a strong union is important, you know, for ensuring that the work that we do is recognized, that, you know, they have the right tools they need to do their job, that they have good benefits, they have good representation. You know, the previous president before me, Tom Moran, did a very good job of representing Fire Rescue. And we are a smaller agency as far as the county goes. We only have about 90 or so employees, but it's very varied, the work, and it's very important, it's very forward-facing. So we need to do a good job of making sure that our employees have what they need to make sure that public safety is met and that we're able to do our job.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and that's, you know, an important distinction when you talk about groups of people that are represented, that people that came together and said, you know what, you know, we want to form and be in a union. You can see the differences between, you know, industries that don't have unions, industries that do have unions, and then those hybrid industries that, you know, some are represented and some are not. And I guess the best example that I can look at is that industry that has some union and some not. And when you have a union presence in an industry, it drives up the benefits and pay and you know, the health and safety and everything else for those people that are unrepresented, because unions care about workers, right? You know, and so to some extent, AME is advocating for its members, but in so doing, it is advocating for all workers. And, you know, I mean, AFL being, you know, a great example of a large umbrella organization that has lots of different specific groups in it. But when they advocate for workers. I, you know, and again, obviously, I would be someone that would take this position, but, you know, having such crucial services provided to the people of Suffolk County for an amazing value, by the way. You know, again, the general fund tax, when averaged out by property, is like less than $100 per lot per year. And the wealth of services just provided by Fres is an amazing value, but it actually is all of the departments that pull out of the general fund to kind of fund operations. So we've talked about, you know, I guess standard issues, things that are just always going on at Fres. But COVID really changed things a lot. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed is where some sectors of the world kind of ramped back, you know, county government had to ramp up. You know, when people are out of work, the labor department needs to do more things. Department of Social Services, their workload goes up. When you have a public health emergency, yeah, it stands to reason that the health department is going to have additional things to do. But so will these call centers. And so will the work of Fres in general. So, I mean, how have you felt like COVID had an impact on the workload in the department?
I think it drastically increased. We still had all of the day-to-day emergencies that had to be handled. But then we had to shift into, obviously, our emergency management ramped up. There was a lot of planning and information that needed to get created and get distributed out. And obviously, you know, this wasn't just a Fres issue. I mean, we were working with our partners in the health department, in parks, DPW, the Suffolk County Sheriff's Office, Suffolk County Police, all coming together. The Office of Emergency Management had to create all of these plans. We had to come out with best policies, best practice, and a lot of this information was constantly evolving. We didn't have the science, so,
right,
you know, we would be changing these almost on a daily or weekly basis. One big project that Fres spearheaded was the distribution of personal protective equipment.
Sure.
To fire departments, EMS, law enforcement, healthcare systems, nursing homes.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, and I want to touch on something, and then I really want to, I kind of want to delve into that, because there's some things I know about this distribution that, to me, are very impressive. But when you talk about the composing and distribution of guidance, you know, coming out of Fres and in collaboration with all these other agencies, you know, you're still dealing with what recommendations are coming from the federal level out of the CDC. You're still dealing with changes coming out of the state level, New York State Department of Health, and especially at the beginning of COVID. I mean, almost daily, if not, you know, sometimes more than once a day, the guidance was changing. And therefore, what everybody could do was changing, and then getting that information out to all our partners was changing. So, I mean, that's a Herculean task all on its own. But I want to talk about this, you know, obtaining and distribution of all the PPE that was necessary. And, you know, there are some unrecognized heroes in this whole process. You know, procurement isn't just done because, you know, someone from the executive's office makes a phone call and says, hey, I need 1 million units of whatever. There are all sorts of people whose job, their function for the county, still coming out of that small pool of money that we talked about earlier, about, you know, less than $100 a year per tax parcel, you know, calling around and finding out, where is this stuff available? Is it viable product, or is it, you know, because there was scam stuff going on and everything else? But most importantly, one of the things that I think, you know, really just struck me is the sheer volume, you know, in terms of dollars, the amount of PPE that was purchased and distributed versus that ratio of material that came in that, you know, maybe could have gotten, you know, contaminated when the box was open or whatever else. Like, the numbers for this department doing something like this for the very first time far exceeded what companies like Amazon have in terms of loss. This was really just an amazing thing being done by county workers for the very first time. And my understanding is, you know, you had a pretty key role in all of that.
Yeah, so I was the operations section chief for that, and I oversaw the distribution. But, I mean, I had a phenomenal group of guys and girls working for me from various agencies, from, like you said, procurement. I had people working in the pod from the fire marshal's office, from the sheriff's office, the police department, parks, probation, and people with various backgrounds. But again, this was not really any of our regular normal day-to-day job. You know, right. At Fres, we do some with logistics and distribution. And, you know, the marathon, we're giving out water and food, but to a certain amount of people. And we're sure. Giving out light towers and message boards. This was an ever-evolving situation where it came out, because the county had a certain amount of stockpile for preparedness. Nobody really was fully prepared for the extent of COVID.
No.
So, you know, we all of a sudden now had to go secure a lot of the stuff that the health department and other agencies had pre-stacked, inventory it, count it. And we very quickly realized that this wasn't going to be a short operation. So we started taking over different buildings and grounds at Fres, at the Fire Academy, constructing portable rack systems, completing storage systems, having to come up with the software to inventory it. Later, we worked with the Department of Information Technology to do it, and they helped us integrate some of this. But literally in the beginning, we were on general receipts on carbon copy paper, just writing receipts and inventorying it, and then eventually spreadsheets. But it was, you know, a lot of who had what experience. All right, you know, I had a delivery route, or I worked at FedEx, or I could drive a forklift. And
right.
Plugging guys and girls in where they fit best. And I think everybody worked well because they found their part of the operation that they could do well. And it was, the mission was so much bigger than anybody individually that everyone just did what they had to do. And I had members who worked 6-7 days a week, 12-hour tours, who had a young child at home that they maybe couldn't be at home as much as they wanted, and who had to also balance out their regular work details with distribution.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's, you know, again, a testament to, you know, the value of a government employee, right? You know, again, private industry could have stepped in and done this, but it would have been a massive cost. And again, that altruism that we talked about, the reason that somebody is attracted to government work in the first place, and including, you know, fire service, EMS, all of that stuff, is because first and foremost, they want to be part of that, their community. They want to be, you know, a valuable asset. And that team did a great job, along with all the other components in the chain, did a great job of just, you know, pulling this whole thing together at a time where, you know, again, it's very recent history, but it's over a year ago. You know, there were shortages everywhere, and people needed to be protected, and services couldn't stop because there wasn't PPE available. So, like, you know, this was literally making sure that all the emergency operations in Suffolk County were maintained and continued, whether or not they were government services, right? Because as you listed, there were outside agencies that definitely needed this PPE as well.
Yeah, that was a big part of the process. Decision-making was, you know, we didn't always know when we were getting our next delivery or how much was coming in. And like you said, the procurement did a phenomenal job of scouring and tracking down all these various leads and then making sure that the product was actually a viable product and it wasn't, you know, maybe a fraudulent or mislabeled product. And then if we only had so many items, the distribution of who was going to go to, some of it was going to go to healthcare, some was going to go to first responders, some was going to go to other essential businesses that might have been private sector partners, that we had to make sure that those stayed open for the viability of the county.
Right. Yeah, no, that, which totally makes sense. And then, you know, just getting back to the call center again, you know, the aspect of the call center that you know, falls under Frez's purview, did you find that, like, during COVID, call volumes increased?
Yes and no. So overall calls for people being sick and COVID-related symptoms obviously spiked, but other things kind of went down in the beginning because people weren't driving as much, people weren't going to the office as much.
Right.
So, you know, like things like motor vehicle accidents, maybe commercial fire alarms decreased, but the overall volume went up. And then for them, they had, we instituted a pandemic protocol through the health department where not everybody who was going to call was going to get an ambulance. And that is something that was never, it was always there, but it was never really enforced or used. So that creates a lot more undue stress onto dispatchers. You're calling 911 because you feel you need help. And the 911 dispatcher has to explain to you on the phone that you're not going to get an ambulance because there's just not enough resources available.
Yeah, well, you know, and part of that, you know, you talk about that stressor and the fact that, you know, resources were stressed. But when you're, you know, when you're taking that phone call and having to say to somebody, you know, you don't meet the criteria necessary to, because, you know, like when you dispatch an ambulance, there's a whole process to getting someone safely in where they need to go and then decontaminating the whole system and having it ready to go again. So if something wasn't at that threshold, to meet that requirement, you couldn't dispatch because then you would be, you know, there would be a disadvantage to people who needed immediate service. But there were probably instances where somebody called and were told, like, listen, we can't send someone out. And then later on called again and now meet the criteria. And that weighs very heavily on people who are, you know, again, by nature, they just want to help. You want to tell everybody, yes, we're going to get somebody out. We're going to help you out. But with the call volume being how it was and the seriousness and you know, the way this stuff was spreading, and I think back to last summer and how the, you know, the numbers were spiking and even then back into the fall, we had that same issue. So, you know, there is a stressor that's on the workers who desire to just say, yes, you're going to get, you know, whatever you need, we're going to send it out and we're going to help. And There's got to be some impact on a personal level at the end of the day to say, you know, I couldn't dispatch, you know, every call that came in.
Yeah. Like you said, the ability to triage and prioritize emergencies is absolutely paramount to what we do, fire, EMS, law enforcement. But at the end of the day, most dispatchers, one of their key components is getting the appropriate resource there in a timely manner. And to now say to somebody, I'm sorry, I can't send you an ambulance right now, I can't send you a fire apparatus or whatever resource you might need, or it's going to be delayed because they have to decontaminate or they have to follow these ever-evolving protocols with COVID, is absolutely stressful. And I think being a dispatcher on its own is a stressful job because every time somebody calls you, it's for an emergency.
Yes.
And, you know, to you, it might be routine, but to them, that's their emergency. That's their loved one. That's their house or that property that needs to be protected.
Yeah. Every time that phone rings, it's probably the worst day in somebody's life.
Absolutely.
And so you know, there are call centers throughout the world that deal with various issues, but emergency call centers, and by emergency, I don't mean like my computer won't start and I have a Zoom meeting, you know, in a little bit, and it's an important, you know, I mean, we're talking life and death in most of these instances. Those services have to be there. They have to be available. You have a limited pool of people doing that work, and the only calls they get are these stressful calls all the time, day in, day out, every year that they work, you know, and people do 30, 35-year careers. just always being in those life or death situations and trying to, you know, calm someone down and get the relevant details that you need. You know, if somebody's like, you know, kind of in a panic and like you said, you know, they don't know north from south. They can't tell the details of the situation that they're in, and maybe three other people are calling in, and everybody's got a small piece of the story, and you still got to piece that together to get the response out. I don't know. To me, that's, you know, it really is a high-pressure job, and that's not to take away from any of the work that anyone else does, but there's just something very special about, you know, the call center work and how that keeps local government running. And that just kind of leads me to something that you know, I think all of our listeners would say, you know, if we were to ask, is a call center operator, an emergency call center operator, a first responder, right? That very first person that you're going to get in touch with is someone in one of these call centers. But as it stands now, New York state law does not recognize these folks as first responders. And it's something that we're working on up in Albany to kind of get that changed and get that understood. There is a bill in play. I think it's working its way through the health committee right now to make sure that all the language lines up exactly the right way. But, you know, what's your take on that effort in general? Just, you know, getting, you know, first responder status for people, you know, that do this kind of work under this kind of stress throughout their whole career that most people already think are first responders. You know, what do you think about the idea of getting the state to recognize them as actually first responders?
I think it's a critical effort that needs to be accomplished. So, you know, we talk about in CPR, the chain of survival, you know, early recognition and then early access to help.
Right.
The dispatcher is the first step in that formal response.
Right.
If there's not somebody to take the phone call, get the appropriate information, start giving those pre-arrival instructions, because they give so many important instructions over the phone, how to perform CPR, how to do the Heimlich. They assist with delivering of children in emergency situations. They give pre-arrival instructions for emergency medical situations, of whether it's the administration of aspirin or other things. Getting all the information as to where exactly we're responding, you know, which door we're using in the house, to making sure that the door is unlocked, that your medications are gathered up, that the lights are on, that if you have any pets, that things that are excluded, things that you and I aren't thinking about on a database situation, let alone in an emergency, that streamlines the process. And then that information is being gathered. It's being given to another dispatcher who's now contacting the fire or EMS or both. Sometimes it's two separate agencies, making sure that that information is relayed to them, that they're constantly being updated, and that this all this information comes together so that when fire and EMS show up at your house, they're already briefed on the situation, they're already up to date, and that care is already being provided before they get there. And the earlier care is provided, the better the outcome for everybody. Same thing, you know, even if it's a fire situation, of understanding, you know, get out of the house, you know, don't make sure everyone's out, don't go back for your valuables.
Right.
And all these things that overall improve public and life safety. And they're that first key component in all this. Without them, the rest of the pieces can't fall into place.
Right. So they are the, you know, again, the way I say it is they are the first responder.
Absolutely.
While we're working on this issue, you know, I just out of curiosity, I mean, how do you feel that 911 operators and dispatchers feel about the idea that as of right now, because of reasons, you know, I guess the state just never got around to it, they're not considered first responders?
I think it was definitely an oversight. It's an unfortunate situation that I believe it needs to be corrected. And I think sometimes they feel either forgotten or relegated to a second line role because they're not, you don't see them on a day-to-day basis. You might talk to them on the phone or talk to them on the radio, but you don't see them where, you know, fire, EMS, law enforcement, we're constantly interacting with each other out at scenes and they're stuck in their room where they're tied to a phone. They're tied to a console for 8 or 16 hours a day. You know, they're locked in and they're stuck and they're constantly going from phone call to phone call, emergency to emergency.
Right.
Where we're taking them one at a time, they're constantly having to stack to it. If they're having multiple, if they're on the console, they might have multiple calls that are monitoring at the same time, and they have to keep responding and updating all of these at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and that's another excellent point. You know, these you reference the console. I mean, it's not, you know, your standard computer. You know, a keyboard, a mouse, and a screen. There are multiple screens, multiple keyboards, multiple mice, because all of these different systems have to be operating in synchronicity. And that's, you know, per per person, right? So each person has to know to grab, you know, the second mouse, or, you know, go to the higher keyboard to get the information in. And, you know, there's a lot to it. And, I, you know, again, that's one of the reasons why we felt it was so important to try and push this legislation forward. And we did have Assemblyman Abate from the state come down and talk to us because, you know, he's the one who is currently carrying that bill and is working with the folks over on the health committee to get those final loopholes kind of closed up. But he did say that he believed, you know, that this was something that was going to happen this year. And I, you know, again, you know, it should be no surprise to anyone that my position is, you know, these are frontline essential workers and absolutely the first responders and should be at the very least recognized as such.
We certainly appreciate everything that the union is doing and that the legislators doing, and this is why unions are so important, because while we feel this is important, you know, individually or as one unit, we're a very small amount of people. But when we have all the power of all the different units together and the AME together, we have a lot more lobbying power and a lot more ability to raise awareness of situations. I think you said earlier, most people, I think, assume that dispatchers already are covered by this, and they're not.
Right.
So I think it's just a matter of raising public awareness. I don't think anyone is really against it as so much as they're not aware that it even needs to be corrected in the first place.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, it's a cost neutral item, right? So when we talk about things happening on the state level that have an impact financially, they usually have to have a fiscal note attached to it. And this is something that's cost neutral. It's just literally saying, why on earth did we not realize that these are first responders, and let's get that cleaned up and let's get that handled. So, you know, we're not talking about impacting taxpayers, operational costs or anything else. We're literally giving long overdue recognition. And John, you know, just real quick, I'm aware of so many amazing stories that happen coming out of Fres, you know, different things that happen on the job. And then, you know, when people are leaving the job on the way home, you know, and they see something and they jump in, and, you know, one story that comes to mind is, you know, someone seeing someone trapped in a car on the drive home and just pulling over, jumping in, getting them out, you know. And are there any stories that really just jump out to you that can kind of illustrate what it is, you know, that really just captures the heart of, you know, the workers at Fres? And again, you have such diversity. I mean, you know, the fire marshals probably have examples, call operators probably have examples, and whatever else. I know, you know, we can't get that, you know, all of the stories, but
I think the vast majority of the people who work at Fres are also volunteers in their outside life. And I think they respond to emergencies on a daily, if not weekly, basis that most people in the public, I think, would be amazed to hear some of these stories. But, you know, the calls that always stick out to me is where the dispatchers are able to, you know, talk to somebody through a childbirth over the phone, of, you know, something that, while it's been going on for a long time, where it's complicated, it's a very stressful situation. You know, you plan for your delivery to be in a hospital with a doctor. Now, things went awry, and the only person you have to help is a person you've never met on the other end of the phone, who you now have to immediately gain rapport and trust with as the dispatcher, and then talk them through what to them is the most important event of their life.
Right.
And you have to do that in a very time-sensitive manner.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that is, in fact, a very fine example. Again, just the kind of thing that I don't think everybody thinks of when they think about, you know, just picking up that phone and making the call. But, you know, John, I want to thank you again. Our guest this morning, John Manzi, Fire Rescue and Emergency Services, and also Unit President at Suffolk AME. Thank you for joining us and just giving us some perspective on the world of, you know, what the members at Fres do.
Thank you for having me on, and thank you for everything you guys are doing to help us out and to move forward with the first responder status of dispatchers. It's an important issue that we feel strongly that needs to be resolved.
Yeah, it's the time has come for sure. And to our listeners, we will speak to you next week.